Good evening, friends, and welcome to Sleepy Time Tales, a podcast aimed at helping you to get a good night's sleep. Do you find your mind plagued with the stresses of modern life, especially when the lights are out and you're trying to get a restful night? Does your spinning mind keep you awake? Follow my voice down the path towards a good night's rest. Listen to me tell a story that will keep your mind from wandering to your daytime problems, the ones you can't solve right now and will be easier to solve well rested. Listen to my voice and allow yourself to drift, following the twists and turns of the story, but slowly letting go and drifting into sleep. Now, many podcasts put their promotion and cup rattling stuff halfway through or even towards the end. But obviously, if I'm hoping you're asleep long before we get there, so I need to put this stuff up front. The show is brought to you by supporters on Patreon. I'm hearing from people all the time how valuable they find the show, and those supporters who have the means to help fund it, to keep it going, and help me to reach new audiences are very much appreciated. So if you're making use of Sleepy Time Tales regularly to help you to deal with sleeplessness, and you have the urge to support the show, and most importantly, if you can and can afford it, please check out patreon.com/sleepytimetales, or go to the link in the show notes or from the website to take a look at what's available there. You will have the satisfaction of knowing that you're contributing to the rest and lifestyle improvements of thousands of people. And over and above that, there are real rewards from as little as $2 a month. There's early release of the regular episodes, weekly bonus episodes, and special edits of the main show. And if joining up committing to a monthly support is a little bit too much to ask for, which is perfectly understandable, other than the Patreon, there's also the tip jar on the website, the merchandise store, and others. But another huge way you can help the show is simply to spread the word. If there is someone in your life who you think will benefit from listening to Sleepy Time Tales, let them know. If you recommend the show on social media, make sure to tag me in so that I know and I can thank you. The tag is @SleepyTimeTales on Instagram or Twitter. I do want to thank a listener, Tila, who sent through a very kind email recently. I'm not going to go into too much detail on it, but it's really nice to know that the choices I make about the structure of the show and how I do it are really do work for certain people. So thank you very, very much, Tila, for your kind words, and I hope you stay well rested. And then, of course, I have to give out the shout out to the music. The song that I can use, as always, is Un Désert by Kumiko from Loyalty Free Music. Their music is available on their website, loyaltyfreemusic.com, and they have a wide variety of stuff produced under different styles. And if you are someone who is doing a creative project like a podcast or YouTube video or something, there's a lot of stuff available there, available for use on Creative Commons licenses, so definitely worth taking a look, as well as actually just listening to, because most of the stuff's actually pretty cool and fun and very varied. So I've also linked the website in the show notes, and please go take a look. Thank you for taking the time, and back to the show. So what exactly is Sleepy Time Tales? What is it for? It is a bit of a strange idea, after all, a podcast that you're supposed to fall asleep to. But lack of sleep is a health crisis in the 21st century, and this is a podcast that is intended to help those that it can to get a restful night. Do you find yourself lying awake at night, with your mind spinning and emotions in turmoil with anxieties of 21st century life? Do you wake up in the middle of the night and find yourself not quite able to doze back off at 3 a.m? I'm here to help. My name is Dave, and I'm your narrator, here to help you into a restful night. I'm someone who has struggled to sleep ever since I was a baby. My parents had sleepless nights with me for years, and even once I got old enough not to be a bother to them anymore, I always struggled to sleep. A lot of people I knew liked sleeping with the TV or the radio on, But it was something I always resisted because I thought silence was more beneficial for me. But later on in life, when I discovered podcasts and I tried to listen to podcasts when I was lying awake at night, that the tendency for droning voices was actually to act almost like a sedative for me. Podcasts, unlike TV or radio, didn't really have quite as many distractions. TV obviously has all the bright light and the loud commercials and potential loud noises, and radio would have distracting music or loud commercials that would disturb my sleep. But podcasts tend to be very consistently evenly toned across the whole length of them, so they actually behaved in a very different way to what other more traditional media do. Now, every episode starts with this long intro. The intro is probably 90% the same every time I go through it, because it has a couple of quite important structural purposes. But I do record it every week to make sure it's a little bit something fresh and something that I've clearly put some care into for listeners. The first and very important thing, obviously, is I need to explain the show to new listeners. I need to make a case for it, explain the structure to it, and kind of explain how I think it's helpful to engage with and why I think it's useful for people to listen to it. People who have been listening to the show for a while now get a very different thing from it. Because I keep it fairly consistent and even the whole way across, it's for them, it's part of the sort of process of getting ready to sleep. What we're trying to do here is prepare yourselves and prepare yourself safe and get ready to sleep. Build a space together, a cabin or a nest, something for you to settle into. Now, as far as I know, there are a couple of different ways to engage with the show. For me, and I think quite a few others, you need something to kind of listen to, something to focus on to an extent. A story or event that keeps your mind on a specific point to stop it from spinning out into stress and anxieties. In a way, it's almost like a guided meditation in a way rather than a storytelling. Something to focus on just enough not to resist the embrace of a night's sleep when it comes for you. Some people may need something a little bit more elemental and primal. Some people just need a background noise. White noise, or the sound of the ocean, or the sound of the wind in the trees, or maybe some boring dude telling you a boring story. And if the latter is yours, I'm your guy. Tonight's story is a lesser-known Charles Dickens work, actually. Did you know that he wrote a series of short detective novels, or stories rather, some of them actually quite good? Tonight's is Hunted, one of those detective works. It gets quite tense and strange and interesting, but it's not particularly action-packed. And I'm going to warn you, I'll leave it shamelessly at a cliffhanger for you to check out if you're interested enough, because it does take a very fascinating turn towards the end. But it's important, whatever the story is, whether it's a completed story or a nasty cliffhanger or my usual thing of just like dropping a chapter halfway through because I think we've gone on long enough, it's very important that you don't force the sleep. Just keep a light mental grip on the thread of the tale and allow the need for sleep to come for you. Now, obviously, if all goes well, I'm hoping you're asleep before I get to the end of the episode, but it is important that you don't feel pressurized. If this is your first night listening to the podcast to Sleepy Time Tales, it actually probably won't work for you. I think it'll probably take a good 2 or 3 nights trying to get used to listening to my voice, to get used to my accent, or just to get over the strangeness of the whole idea and realize that you can trust me and I'm not going to do anything weird or say anything weird while you're asleep. It's also possible, especially if it's early in days with the podcast, that one episode just isn't long enough. What I do with my sleep podcasts is I queue up a few episodes. I usually download a bunch and then I start on the latest one and then I let them play through the night. I lie down in the dark with my earbuds in and I let them run. Because my sleep habits actually have changed in the last couple of years, It's not so much the going to sleep that's a struggle for me, but it's the waking up at 3 a.m. and kind of not realizing that I'm entirely awake, and then my mind sort of wakes up and starts spinning, and then I'm like, oh, I've been awake for an hour and a half, and I'm not going to actually sleep again. So what I do is, if my earbuds are popped out, the stream is still running, I'll pop them in, and I let the voices waft me back to sleep again. Sometimes I even wake up like 30 minutes before my alarm goes, and I do the exact same thing. I carry on listening, and it knocks me right back out again. And I've got to tell you, it may sound strange, but that 30 minutes is sometimes the most restful part of my night. There is something about allowing yourself to relax completely right before the alarm that's just deeply, deeply satisfying. But whether you're trying to go to sleep first thing in the night, or waking up in the middle of the night, or just trying to get a few extra 40 winks in before the alarm, it's very important that you try to relax. If you're new to the show and prone to late nights lying staring at the ceiling, this will probably seem strange to you. So I suggest you give it a chance. And that's the basic idea. You relax and you lie in the dark, and while you do that, I tell you a tale. So relax, dear listener, my nighttime friend who has elected to lie in the dark, listening to my voice. You will always be safe with me. I'm here to help you relax, to improve your life in a small way. Or, honestly, maybe not such a small way. People don't sleep very well these days, and it makes their lives harder, so I'm here to do a small part to help you in a big way. To help you to face tomorrow and the day after, well rested and better able to cope and process. I believe very strongly in the benefits of kindness. I want to be kind to you. I want to share kindness with you. And I need you to be kind to yourself. Don't beat yourself up or rebuke yourself over not sleeping. Don't get tense if you just can't get yourself over the edge of sleep, even with me here in your ears trying to help. Frustration is one of the great enemies of a good night's sleep, and the intention with this podcast is to short-circuit that frustration. To distract the feeling we get when we blame ourselves for not being able to let go and drift into the dark. So take a breath. Forgive the fact you can't sleep and let my voice wash over you. Take another breath. Imagine the warm darkness rising up, inviting you to sleep and to a better life starting tomorrow. And if you can't let go, forgive yourself and we can try again tomorrow. If you've had a life of insomnia, sleep is something like an enemy. But it is not your enemy. It's a natural process that we've been pulled away from by stress and life and supposed progress shining bright lights in our eyes at all hours. I'm here to work with you. To create a safe space. A cocoon in which you can curl up and allow nature to take its course. So if you're still with me, thank you for staying. If you're already asleep, we'll chat again soon. And of course, you aren't hearing me, except maybe in a dream. Hunted Down, the Detective Stories of Charles Dickens. Chapter 1. Most of us see some romances in life. In my capacity as chief manager of a life assurance office, I think I have, within the last 30 years, seen more romances than the generality of men, however unpromising the opportunity may at first sight seem. As I have retired and live at my ease, I possess the means that I used to want, of considering what I have seen at leisure. My experiences have a more remarkable aspect, so reviewed, than they had when they were in progress. I have come home from the play now, and can recall the scenes of the drama upon which the curtain had fallen, free from the glare, bewilderment, and bustle of the theatre. Let me recall one of these romances of the real world. There is nothing truer than physiognomy, taken in connection with manner, the art of reading that book of which eternal wisdom obliges every human creature to present his or her own page with the individual character written on it, is a difficult one, perhaps, and is little studied. It may require some natural aptitude, and it must require, for everything does, some patience and some pains. That these are not usually given to it, that numbers of people accept a few stock commonplace expressions of the face as the whole list of characteristics, and neither seek nor know the refinements that are truest. That you, for instance, give a great deal of time and attention to the reading of music, Greek, Latin, French, Italian, Hebrew, if you please, and do not qualify yourself to read the face of the master or mistress looking over your shoulder teaching it to you. I assume to be 500 times more probable than improbable. Perhaps a little self-sufficiency may be at the bottom of this. Facial expression requires no study from you, you think. It comes by nature to you to know enough about it, and you are not to be taken in. I confess for my part that I have been taken in, over and over again. I have been taken in by acquaintances, and I have been taken in, of course, by friends. Far oftener by friends than by any other class of persons. How came I to be so deceived? Had I quite misread their faces? No, believe me, my first impression of those people founded on face and manner alone was invariably true. My mistake was in suffering them to come nearer to me and explain themselves away. Chapter 2. The partition which separated my own office from our general outer office in the city was a thick plate glass. I could see through it what passed in the outer office without hearing a word. I had it put up in the place of a wall that had been there for years, ever since the house was built. It is no matter whether I did or did not make the change in order that I might derive my first impression of strangers who came to us on business from their faces alone, without being influenced by anything they said. Enough to mention that I turned my glass partition to that account, and that a life assurance office is at all times exposed to be practiced upon by the most crafty and cruel of the human race. It was through my glass partition that I first saw the gentleman whose story I am going to tell. He had come in without my observing it, and had put his hat and umbrella on the broad counter, and was bending over it to take some papers from one of the clerks. He was about 40 or so, dark, exceedingly well dressed in black, being in mourning, and the hand he extended with a polite air had a particularly well-fitting black kid glove upon it. His hair, which was elaborately brushed and oiled, was parted straight up the middle, and he presented this parting to the clerk, exactly to my thinking, as if he had said in so many words, "You must take me, if you please, my friend, as I show myself. Come straight up here, follow the gravel path, keep off the grass. I allow no trespassing." I conceived a very great aversion to that man the moment I thus saw him. He had asked for some of our printed forms, and the clerk was giving them to him and explaining them. An obliged and agreeable smile was on his face, and his eyes met those of the clerk with a sprightly look. "I have known a vast quantity of nonsense talked about bad men not looking you in the face. Don't trust that conventional idea. Dishonesty will stare honesty out of countenance any day of the week, if there was anything to be got by it." I saw in the corner of his eyelash that he became aware of my looking at him. Immediately he turned the parting in his hair towards the glass partition, as if he said to me with a sweet smile, "Straight up here, if you please, off the grass." In a few moments he had put his hat on and taken up his umbrella and was gone. I beckoned the clerk to my room and asked, "Who was that?" He had the gentleman's card in his hand. "Mr. Julius Slington, Middle Temple." "A barrister, Mr. Adams?" "I think not, sir." "I should have thought him a clergyman, but for his having no reverend here," said I. "Probably from his appearance," Mr. Adams replied. "He's reading for orders. I should mention that he wore a dainty white cravat and dainty linen altogether. What did he want, Mr. Adams? Merely a form of proposal, sir, in form of reference. Recommended here, did he say? Yes, he said he was recommended here by a friend of yours. He noticed you, but said that as he had not had the pleasure of your personal acquaintance, he would not trouble you. Did he know my name? Oh yes, sir, he said, there is Mr. Sampson, I see. A well-spoken gentleman, apparently? Remarkably so, sir. Insinuating manners, apparently? Very much so, indeed, sir. Ha, I said. I want nothing at present, Mr. Adams. Within a fortnight of that day, I went to dine with a friend of mine, a merchant, a man of taste who buys pictures and books, and the first man I saw among the company was Mr. Julius Slington. There he was, standing before the fire, with good large eyes and an open expression of face, but still, I thought, requiring everybody to come at him by the prepared way he offered and by no other. I noticed him ask my friend to introduce him to Mr. Sampson, and my friend did so. Mr. Slington was very happy to see me. Not too happy, there was no overdoing of the matter. Happy in a thoroughly well-bred, perfectly unmeaning way. I thought you had met, our host observed. No, said Mr. Slington. I did look in at Mr. Sampson's office on your recommendation, but I really did not feel justified in troubling Mr. Sampson himself on a point in the everyday routine of an ordinary clerk. I said I should have been glad to show him any attention on our friend's introduction. I'm sure of that, said he, and I'm much obliged. At another time, perhaps, I may be less delicate. Only, however, if I have real business, for I know, Mr. Sampson, how precious business time is, and what a vast number of impertinent people there are in the world. I acknowledged his consideration with a slight bow. You were thinking, said I, of effecting a policy on your life. Oh dear, no. I'm afraid I'm not so prudent as you pay me the compliment of supposing me to be, Mr. Sampson. I merely inquired for a friend. But you know what friends are in such matters. Nothing may ever come of it. I have the greatest reluctance to trouble men of business with inquiries for friends, knowing the probabilities to be 1,000 to 1. That the friends will ever follow them up. People are so fickle, so selfish, so inconsiderate. Don't you and your business find them so every day, Mr. Sampson? I was going to give a qualified answer, but he turned his smooth white parting on me with its straight up here, if you please, and I answered, yes. I hear, Mr. Sampson, he resumed presently, for our friend had a new cook and dinner was not so punctual as usual, that your profession has recently suffered a great loss. In money, said I. He laughed at my ready association of loss with money and replied, no, in talent and vigour. Not at once following out his allusion, I considered for a moment. Has it sustained a loss of that kind, said I? I was not aware of it. Understand me, Mr. Sampson, I don't imagine that you have retired. It is not so bad as that. But Mr. Meltham? Oh, to be sure, said I. Yes, Mr. Meltham, the young actuary of the inestimable. Just so, he returned in a consoling way. Here's a great loss. He was at once the most profound, the most original, and the most energetic man I've ever known connected with life assurance. I spoke strongly, for I had high esteem and admiration for Meltham, and my gentleman had indefinitely conveyed to me some suspicion that he wanted to sneer at him. He recalled me to my guard by presenting that trim pathway up his head with its internal, not on the grass, if you please, the gravel. You knew him, Mr. Slington? Only by reputation. To have known him as an acquaintance or as a friend is an honour I should have sought if he had remained in society, though I might never have had the good fortune to attain it, being a man of far inferior mark. He was scarcely above 30, I suppose. About 30. Ah, he sighed in his former consoling way. What creatures we are. To break up Mr. Sampson and become incapable of business at that time of life. Any reason assigned for the melancholy fact? Thought I, as I looked at him. But I won't go up the track, and I will go on the grass. What reason have you heard assigned, Mr. Slington? I asked, point blank. Most likely a false one. You know what rumour is, Mr. Sampson. I never repeat what I hear. It is the only way of paring the nails and shaving the head of rumour. But when you ask me what reason I have heard assigned for Mr. Meltham's passing away from among men, it is another thing. I'm not gratifying idle gossip then. I was told, Mr. Sampson, that Mr. Meltham had relinquished all his avocations and all his prospects, because he was, in fact, broken-hearted. A disappointed attachment, I heard, though it hardly seems probable in the case of a man so distinguished and so attractive. Attractions and distinctions are no armour against death, said I. Oh, she died. Pray pardon me, I did not hear that. That indeed makes it very, very sad. Poor Mr. Meltham. She died? Oh, dear me. Lamentable, lamentable. I still thought his pity was not quite genuine, and I still suspected an unaccountable sneer under all this, until he said, as we were parted, like the other knots of talkers, by the announcement of dinner. Mr. Sampson, you are surprised to see me so moved on behalf of a man whom I have never known. I am not so disinterested as you may suppose. I have suffered, and recently too, from death myself. I have lost one of two charming nieces who are my constant companions. She died young, barely 23, and even her remaining sister is far from strong. The world is a grave. He said this with deep feeling, and I felt reproached for the coldness of my manner. Coldness and distrust had been engendered in me, I knew, by my bad experiences. They were not natural to me. And I often thought how much I had lost in life, losing trustfulness, and how little I had gained, gaining hard caution. This state of mind being habitual to me, I troubled myself more about this conversation than I might have troubled myself about a greater matter. I listened to his talk at dinner and observed how readily other men responded to it, and with what a graceful instinct he adapted his subjects to the knowledge and habits of those he talked with. As, in talking with me, he had easily started the subject I might be supposed to understand best and to be the most interested in, so in talking with others he guided himself by the same rule. The company was of varied character, but he was not at fault, that I could discover, with any member of it. He knew just as much of each man's pursuit as made him agreeable to that man in reference to it, and just as little as it made him natural in him to seek modestly for information when a theme was broached. As he talked and talked, but really not too much, for the rest of us seemed to force it upon him, I became quite angry with myself. I took his face to pieces in my mind like a watch and examined it in detail. I could not say much against any of his features separately. I could not even less against them when they were put together. Then is it not monstrous, I asked myself, that because a man happens to part his hair straight up the middle of his head, I would permit myself to suspect and even to detest him. I may stop to remark that this was no proof of my sense. An observer of men who finds himself steadily repelled by some appealingly trifling thing as a stranger is right to give it great weight. It may be the clue to the whole mystery. A hair or two will show where a lion is hidden. A very little key will open a very heavy door. I took my part in the conversation with him after a time, and we got on remarkably well. In the drawing room, I asked the host how long he had known Mr. Slington. He answered, not many months. He had met him at the house of a celebrated painter then present, who had known him well when he was travelling with his nieces in Italy for their health. His plans in life being broken by the death of one of them, he was reading with the intention of going back to college as a matter of form, taking his degree and going into orders. I could not but argue with myself that there was the true explanation of his interest in poor Meltham, and that I had been almost brutal in my distrust on that simple head. Chapter 3. On the very next day but one, I was sitting behind my glass partition, as before, when he came into the outer office, as before. The moment I saw him again without hearing him, I hated him worse than ever. It was only for a moment that I had this opportunity, for he waved his tight-fitting black glove the instant I looked at him and came straight in. Mr. Sampson, good day. I presume you see upon your kind permission to intrude upon you. I don't keep my word in being justified by business, for my business here, if I may so abuse the word, is of the slightest nature. I asked, was it anything I could assist him in? I think you know. I merely called to inquire outside whether my dilatory friend has been so false to himself as to be practical and sensible. But of course he has done nothing. I gave him your papers with my own hand and he was hot upon the intention. But of course he has done nothing. Apart from the general human disinclination to do anything that ought to be done, I dare say there's a speciality about assuring one's life. You find it like will-making. People are so superstitious and take it for granted they will die soon afterwards. Up here, if you please. Straight up here, Mr. Sampson. Neither to the right nor left. I almost fancied I could hear him breathe the words as he sat smiling at me, with that intolerable parting exactly opposite the bridge of my nose. There is such a feeling sometimes, no doubt, I replied, but I don't think it obtains to any great extent. Well, said he, with a shrug and a smile, I wish some good angel would influence my friend in the right direction. I rashly promised his mother and sister in Norfolk to see it done, and he promised them that he would do it. But I suppose he never will. He spoke for a minute or two on indifferent topics and went away. I had scarcely unlocked the drawers of my writing table next morning when he reappeared. I noticed that he came straight to the door in the glass partition and did not pause a single moment outside. Can you spare me 2 minutes, my dear Mr. Sampson? By all means. Much obliged. Laying his hat and umbrella on the table, I came only not to interrupt you. The fact is, I am taken by surprise in reference to this proposal my friend has made. Has he made one? Said I. Yes, he answered, deliberately looking at me, and then a bright idea seemed to strike him. Or he only tells me he has. Perhaps that may be a new way of evading the matter. By Jupiter, I never thought of that. Mr. Adams was opening the morning's letters in the outer office. What is the name, Mr. Slington? I asked him. Beckwith. I looked out at the door and requested Mr. Adams, if there were a proposal in that name, to bring it in. He had already laid it out of his hand on the counter. It was easily selected from the rest and he gave it me. Alfred Beckwith, proposal to effect a policy with us for £2,000, dated yesterday. From the Middle Temple, I see, Mr. Slington. Yes, he lives on the same staircase with me. His door is opposite. I never thought he would make me his reference, though. It seems quite natural that he should. Quite so, Mr. Sampson, but I never thought of it. Let me see. He took the printed paper from his pocket. How am I to answer all these questions? According to the truth, of course, said I. Oh, of course, he answered, looking up from the paper with a smile. I meant there were so many, but you do right to be particular. It stands reason that you must be particular. Will you allow me to use your pen and ink? Certainly. Into your desk? Certainly. He had been hovering about between his hat and his umbrella for a place to write on. He now sat down in my chair at my blotting paper and inkstand, with a long walk up his head in accurate perspective before me, as I stood with my back to the fire. Before answering each question, he ran over it aloud and discussed it. How long had he known Mr. Alfred Beckwith? That he had to calculate by years upon his fingers. What were his habits? No difficulty about them, temperate in the last degree, and took a little too much exercise, if anything. All the answers were satisfactory. When he had written them all, he looked them over and finally signed them in a very pretty hand. He supposed he had now done with the business. I told him that he was not likely to be troubled any farther. Should he leave the papers there? If he pleased. Much obliged. Good morning. I'd had one other visitor before him, not at the office, but at my own house. That visitor had come to my bedside when it was not yet daylight, and had been seen by no one else but by my faithful confidential servant. A second reference paper, for we required always two, was sent down into Norfolk, and it was duly received back by post. This, likewise, was satisfactorily answered in every respect. Our forms were all complied with, we accepted the proposal, and the premium for 1 year was paid. Chapter 4. For 6 or 7 months I saw no more of Mr. Slington. He called once at my house, but I was not at home, and he once asked me to dine with him in the temple, but I was engaged. His friend's assurance was effected in March. Late in September or early in October, I was down at Scarborough for a breath of sea air when I met him on the beach. It was a hot evening. He came towards me with his hat in his hand, and there was the walk I had felt so strongly disinclined to take in perfect order again exactly on the front of the bridge of my nose. He was not alone, but had a young lady on his arm. She was dressed in mourning, and I looked at her with great interest. She had the appearance of being extremely delicate, and her face was remarkably pale and melancholy, but she was very pretty. He introduced her as his niece, Miss Nina. "Are you strolling, Mr. Sampson? Is it possible you can be idle?" It was possible, and I was strolling. "Shall we stroll together?" "With pleasure." The young lady walked between us, and we walked on the cool sea sand in the direction of Filey. "There have been wheels here," said Mr. Slington, "and now I look again, the wheels of a hand carriage. Margaret, my love, your shadow without a doubt." "Miss Nina's shadow," I repeated, looking down at it on the sand. "Not that one," Mr. Slington returned, laughing. "Margaret, my dear, tell Mr. Sampson." "Indeed," said the young lady, turning to me, "there is nothing to tell, except that I constantly see the same invalid old gentleman at all times wherever I go. I have mentioned it to my uncle, and he calls the gentleman my shadow." "Does he live in Scarborough?" I asked. "He is staying there." "Do you live in Scarborough?" "No, I am staying here. My uncle has placed me with a family here for my health." "And your shadow?" said I, smiling. "My shadow," she answered, smiling too, "is, like myself, not very robust, I fear. For I lose my shadow sometimes, as my shadow loses me at other times. We both seem liable to confinement to the house. I have not seen my shadow for days and days, but it does oddly happen, occasionally, that wherever I go, for many days together, this gentleman goes. We have come together in the most unfrequented nooks on this shore." The wheels had swept down to the water's edge and described a great loop on the sand in turning. Bringing the loop back towards us and spinning it out as it came was a hand carriage drawn by a man. "Yes," said Miss Nina, "this really is my shadow, uncle." As the carriage approached us and we approached the carriage, I saw within it an old man, whose head was sunk on his breast and who was enveloped in a variety of wrappers. He was drawn by a very quiet but very keen-looking man, with grey iron hair, who was slightly lame. They had passed us when the carriage stopped, and the old gentleman within, putting out his arm, called to me by name. I went back and was absent from Mr. Slington and his niece for about 5 minutes. When I rejoined them, Mr. Slington was the first to speak. "Indeed," he said to me in a raised voice before I came up with him. "It is well you have not been longer, or my niece might have died from curiosity to know who her shadow is, Mr. Sampson." "An old East India director," said I, "an intimate friend of our friends, at whose house I first had the pleasure of meeting you, a certain Major Banks. You have never heard of him?"
"Never."
"Very rich, Miss Nina, but very old and very crippled. An amiable man, sensible, much interested in you. He has just been expatiating on the affection that he has observed to exist between you and your uncle." Mr. Slington was holding his hat again, and he passed his hand up the straight walk, as if he himself went up it serenely after me. "Mr. Sampson," he said, tenderly pressing his niece's arm in his, "our affection was always a strong one, for we have had but few near ties. We have still fewer now. We have associations to bring us together that are not of this world, Margaret." "Dear uncle," murmured the young lady, and turned her face to hide her tears. "My niece and I have such remembrances and regrets in common, Mr. Sampson," he feelingly pursued, "that it would be strange indeed if the relations between us were cold or indifferent. If I remember a conversation we once had together, you will understand the reference I make. Cheer up, dear Margaret. Don't droop. Don't droop. My Margaret, I cannot bear to see you droop." The poor young lady was very much affected, but controlled herself. His feelings, too, were very acute. In a word, he found himself under such great need of a restorative that he presently went away to take a bath of seawater, leaving the young lady and me sitting by a point of rock and probably presuming, but that you will say was a pardonable indulgence in a luxury, that she would praise him with all her heart. And she did, poor thing. With all her confiding heart, she praised him to me for his care of her dead sister and for his untiring devotion in her last illness. The sister had wasted away very slowly, and wild and terrible fantasies had come over her towards the end. But he had never been impatient with her or at a loss, had always been gentle, watchful, and self-possessed. The sister had known him, as she had known him, to be the best of men, the kindest of men, and yet a man of such admirable strength of character as to be a very tower for the support of their weak natures while their poor lives endured. "I shall leave him, Mr. Sampson, very soon," said the young lady. "I know my life is drawing to an end, and when I am gone I hope he will marry and be happy. I am sure he has lived single so long only for my sake and for my poor, poor sister's." The little hand carriage had made another great loop on the damp sand and was coming back again, gradually spinning out a slim figure of 8, half a mile along. "Young lady," said I, looking around, laying my hand upon her arm and speaking in a low voice, "time presses. You hear the gentle murmur of that sea?" She looked at me with the utmost wonder and alarm, saying, "Yes." "And you know what a voice is in it when the storm comes?" "Yes." "You see how quiet and peaceful it lies before us, and you know what an awful sight of power without pity it might be this very night?" "Yes." "But if you had never seen it, or heard of it in its cruelty, could you believe that it beats every inanimate thing in its way to pieces, without mercy, and destroys lives without remorse?" "You terrify me, sir, by these questions." "To save you, young lady, to save you. For God's sake, collect your strength and collect your firmness. If you were here alone and hemmed in by the rising tide on the floe to 50 feet above your head, you could not be in greater danger than the danger you are now to be saved from." The figure on the sand was spun out and straggled off into a crooked little jerk that ended at the cliff very near us. "As I am, before heaven and the judge of all mankind, your friend, and your dear sister's friend,
I solemnly entreat you, Miss Nana, without one moment's loss of time, to come to this gentleman with me. If the little carriage had been less near to us, I doubt if I could have got her away. But it was so near that where we were before she had recovered the hurry of being urged from the rock. I did not remain there with her 2 minutes. Certainly within 5, I had the inexpressible satisfaction of seeing her, from the point we had sat on, into which I had returned, half supported and half carried up to some rude steps notched in the cliff by the figure of an active man. With that figure beside her, I knew she was safe anywhere. I sat alone on the rock, awaiting Mr. Slington's return. The twilight was deepening and the shadows were heavy when he came round the point, with his hat hanging in his buttonhole, smoothing his wet hair with one of his hands and picking out the path with the other in a pocket comb. "My niece is not here, Mr. Sampson," he said, looking about. Miss Nana seemed to feel a chill in the air after the sun was down and has gone home. He looked surprised, as though she were not accustomed to do anything without him, even to originate so slight a proceeding. "I persuaded Miss Nana," I explained. "Ah," said he, "she is easily persuaded, for her good. Thank you, Mr. Sampson, she is better within doors. The bathing place was further than I thought, to say the truth." "Miss Nana is very delicate," I observed. He shook his head and drew a deep sigh. "Very, very, very. You may recollect my saying so. The time that has since intervened has not strengthened her. The gloomy shadow that fell upon her sister so early in life seems in my anxious eyes to gather over her, ever darker, ever darker. Dear Margaret, but we must hope." The hand carriage was spinning away before us at a most indecorous pace for an invalid vehicle, and was making most irregular curves upon the sand. Mr. Slington, noticing it after he had put his handkerchief to his eyes, said, "If I may judge from appearances, your friend will be upset, Mr. Sampson." "It looks probable, certainly," said I. "The servant must be drunk." "The servants of old gentlemen will get drunk sometimes," said I. "The Major draws very light, Mr. Sampson." "The Major does draw light," said I. By this time the carriage, much to my relief, was lost in the darkness. We walked on for a little, side by side over the sand in silence. After a short while, he said, in a voice still affected by the emotion that his niece's state of health had awakened in him, "Do you stay here long, Mr. Sampson?" "Why, no, I'm going away tonight."
"So soon?"
"But business always holds you in request. Men like Mr. Sampson are too important to others to be spared to their own need of relaxation and enjoyment." "I don't know about that," said I. "However, I'm going back."
"To London?"
"To London."
"I shall be there too, soon after you."
I knew that as well as he did, but I did not tell him so, any more than I told him what defensive weapon my right hand rested on in my pocket as I walked by his side, any more than I told him why I did not walk on the seaside of him with the night closing in. We left the beach and our ways diverged. We exchanged good night and had parted indeed when he said, returning, "Mr. Sampson, may I ask? Poor Meltham, whom we spoke of, dead yet?" "Not when I last heard of him, but too broken a man to live long and hopelessly lost to his old calling." "Dear, dear, dear," he said, with great feeling, "sad, sad, sad. The world is a grave," and so went his way. It was not his fault if the world were not a grave, but I did not call that observation after him, any more than I'd mentioned those things just now enumerated. He went his way and I went mine with all expedition. This happened, as I have said, either at the end of September or beginning of October. The next time I saw him, and the last time, was late in November. Chapter 5. I had a very particular engagement to breakfast in the temple. It was a bitter northeasterly morning and the sleet and slush lay inches deep in the streets. I could get no conveyance and was soon wet to the knees, but I should have been true to the appointment, although I had to wade to it up to my neck in the same impediments. The appointment took me to some chambers in the temple. They were at the top of a lonely corner house overlooking the river. The name Mr. Alfred Beckwith was painted on the outer door. On the door opposite, on the same landing, the name Mr. Julius Slington. The doors of both sets of chambers stood open so that anything said aloud in one set could be heard in the other. I had never been in these chambers before. They were dismal, close, unwholesome, and oppressive. The furniture, originally good and not yet old, was faded and dirty. The rooms were in great disorder, and there was a strong prevailing smell of opium, brandy, and tobacco. The grate and fire irons were splashed all over with unsightly blotches of rust, and on a sofa by the fire in the room where the breakfast had been preserved lay the host. Mr. Beckwith, a man with all the appearance of the worst kind of drunkard, was very far advanced on his shameful way to death. "Slington has not come yet," said this creature, staggering up when I went in. "I'll call him. Halloa, Julius Caesar, come and drink." As he hoarsely roared this out, he beat the poker and tongs together in a mad way, as if that were his usual manner of summoning his associate. The voice of Mr. Slington was heard through the clatter from the opposite side of the staircase, and he came in. He had not expected the pleasure of meeting me. I have seen several artful men brought to a stand, but I've never seen a man so aghast as he was when his eyes rested on mine. "Julius Caesar," cried Beckwith, staggering between us. "Mr. Samson, Mr. Samson, Julius Caesar. Julius, Mr. Samson is the friend of my soul. Julius keeps me plied with liquor morning, noon, and night. Julius is a real benefactor. Julius threw the tea and coffee out the window when I used to have any. Julius empties all the water jugs of their contents and fills them with spirits. Julius winds me up and keeps me going. Boil the brandy, Julius." There was a rusty and furred saucepan in the ashes. The ashes looked like the accumulation of weeks, and Beckwith, rolling and staggering between us as if he were going to plunge headlong into the fire, got the saucepan out and tried to force it into Slington's hand. "Boil the brandy, Julius Caesar. Come, do your usual office. Boil the brandy." He became so fierce in his gesticulations with the saucepan that I expected to see him lay open Slington's head with it. I therefore put out my hand to check him. He reeled back to the sofa and sat there panting, shaking and red-eyed in his rags of dressing gowns, looking at us both. I noticed then that there was nothing to drink on the table but brandy and nothing to eat but salted herons and a hot, sickly, highly peppered stew. "At all events, Mr. Samson," said Slington, offering me the smooth gravel path for the last time, "I thank you for interfering between me and this unfortunate man's violence. However you came here, Mr. Samson, or with whatever motive you came here, at least I thank you for that." "Boil the brandy," muttered Beckwith. Without gratifying his desire to know how I came here, I said quietly, "How is your niece, Mr. Slington?" He looked hard at me, and I looked hard at him. "I'm sorry to say, Mr. Samson, that my niece has proved treacherous and ungrateful to her best friend. She left me without a word of notice or explanation. She was misled, no doubt, by some designing rascal. Perhaps you may have heard of it." "I did hear that she was misled by a designing rascal. In fact, I have proof of it." "Are you sure of that?" said he. "Quite." "Boil the brandy," muttered Beckwith. "Company to breakfast, Julius Caesar. Do your usual office. Provide the usual breakfast, dinner, tea, and supper. Boil the brandy." The eyes of Slington looked from him to me, and he said after a moment's consideration, "Mr. Samson, you are a man of the world, and so am I. I will be plain with you." "Oh, no, you won't," said I, shaking my head. "I tell you, sir, I will be plain with you." "And I tell you, you will not," said I. "I know all about you. You, plain with anyone? Nonsense, nonsense. I plainly tell you, Mr. Sampson, he went on with a manner almost composed, that I understand you object. You want to save your funds and escape from your liabilities. These are all tricks of the trade with you, office gentlemen. But you will not do it, sir, you will not succeed. You have not an easy adversary to play against when you play against me. We shall have to inquire in due time when and how Mr. Beckwith fell into his present habits. With that remark, sir, I'll put this poor creature and his incoherent wanderings of speech aside, and wish you a good morning and better case next time. While he was saying this, Beckwith had filled a half-pint glass with brandy. At this moment, he threw the brandy at his face and threw the glass after it. Slington put his hands up, half-blinded with the spirit, and cut the glass across his forehead. At the sound of the breakage, a fourth person came into the room, closed the door, and stood at it. He was a very quiet but very keen-looking man with iron-grey hair and slightly lame. Slington pulled out his handkerchief, assuaged the pain in his smarting eyes, and dabbled the blood on his forehead. He was a long time about it, and I saw that in doing of it, a tremendous change had come over him, occasioned by the change in Beckwith. He ceased to pant and tremble, sat upright, and never took his eyes off him. I never in my life saw a face in which abhorrence and determination were so forcibly painted as in Beckwith's then. "Look at me, you villain," said Beckwith, "and see me as I really am. I took these rooms to make a trap for you. I came into them as a drunkard to bait the trap for you. You fell into the trap and you will never leave it alive. On the morning when you last went to Mr. Sampson's office, I had seen him first. Your plot has been known to both of us all along, and you have been counterplotted all along. What, having been cajoled into putting that prize of £2,000 in your power, I was to be done to death with brandy, and brandy not proving quick enough with something quicker? Have I never seen you, when you thought my senses gone, pouring from your little bottle into my glass? Why, you murderer and forger, alone here with you in the dead of night, as I have so often been, I've had my hand upon the trigger of a pistol 20 times to blow your brains out." The sudden starting up of the thing that he had supposed to be his imbecile victim into a determined man, with a settled resolution to hunt him down and be the death of him, mostly expressed from head to foot, was the first shock too much for him. Without any figure of speech, he staggered under it. But there is no greater mistake than to suppose that a man who is a calculating criminal is in any phase of his guilt otherwise than true to himself, and perfectly consistent with his whole character. Such a man commits murder, and murder is the natural culmination of his course. Such a man has to outface murder and will do it with hardihood and effrontery. It's sort of fashion to express surprise that any notorious criminal, having such a crime upon his conscience, can so brave it out. Do you think that if he had it on his conscience at all, or had a conscience to have it upon, he would have even committed the crime? Perfectly consistent with himself, as I believe all such monsters to be, the Slington recovered himself and showed a defiance that was sufficiently cold and quiet. He was white, he was haggard, he was changed, but only as a sharper who had played for a great stake and had been outwitted and had lost the game. "Listen to me, you villain," said Beckwith, "and at every word you hear me, save a stab in your wicked heart. When I took these rooms, to throw myself in your way and lead you onto the scheme that I knew my appearance and supposed character and habits would suggest to such a devil, how did I know that? Because you were no stranger to me, I knew you well, and I knew you to be the cruel wretch who for so much money had killed one innocent girl while she trusted him implicitly, and who was by inches killing another." Slington took out a snuff box, took a pinch of snuff, and laughed. "But see here," said Beckwith, never looking away, never raising his voice, never relaxing his face, never unclenching his hand. "See what a dull wolf you have been after all. Infatuated drunkard who never drank a 50th part of the liquor you plied him with, but poured it away here, there, everywhere, almost before your eyes. Who bought over the fellow you set to watch him and to ply him by outbidding you in his bribe, before he had been at his work 3 days. With whom you have observed no caution, yet who was so bent on ridding the earth of you as a wild beast that it would have defeated you if it had ever been so prudent. That drunkard, whom you have many a time left on the floor of this room, and has even let you go out of it, alive and undeceived, when you have turned him over with your foot, has almost as often, on the same night, within an hour, within a few minutes, watched you awake, had his hand at your pillow when you were asleep, turned over your papers, taken samples from your bottles and packets of powder, changed their contents, raffled every secret of your life. He'd had another pinch of snuff in his hand, but had gradually let it drop from between his fingers to the floor, where he now smoothed it out with his foot, looking down at it the while. And I think I'm actually going to leave it there. Bit of a nasty cliffhanger. There's not much of the story left to go, but a little bit too much to read out. So if you want to see the exciting conclusion of this, take a look at it on Project Gutenberg at the link in the show notes. Thanks again for joining me on this episode of Sleepy Time Tales, a podcast designed around a bedtime story to help you to get a restful night. New episodes are released every Sunday night to give you something fresh to help you rest in a new week. But make sure to subscribe in whatever service you use so that you get new episodes whenever they come out. A reminder that the music for tonight is Un Désert by Komiku. Check out more of their work on their website, which you'll find linked in the show notes. Good night, and sweet dreams.